and many journalists generally, they come to this work as a call to keep communities informed, to act as a check and balance of those who wield power or who seek to influence it, to ensure the wheels of commerce turn responsibly and fairly, and to keep society cohesive. There's also the keen pursuit of truth and accuracy, rather than the pursuit of celebrity and personality. Those, at least, are the things that have typically characterised a career or an undertaking in journalism. Now, these things might have been easier when newspapers were directly connected to and deeply rooted in their communities because their owners lived there, or when TV and radio, generally less community-based, but at least had the resources to be deep and broad broadcasters. We're now in an environment where established, or we might say establishment, news gatherers and disseminators are huge multinational corporates. And we have an emerging generation of people who are more reliant on the web as their source of information than their local daily newspaper. So what does that mean for the craft of journalism? And where does that leave the job? And does it change its purpose? Well, these are the big questions, and these are important issues. The role that the media plays is not to be lightly regarded in our society and our communities. We need an effective media for effective democracy and a healthy society. So I personally look forward to the discussions and the debate this weekend. It's great and very heartening to see such a diverse range of people, of practitioners, people in the craft, and of different interests. We have journalists here from all media types, newspaper, radio, web, broadcasters, agencies, freelancers, academics and so on. I'm not sure whether we have anybody here from TVNZ. I hope they weren't concerned with any views they might express on them in trouble, but all views are welcome and are necessary if we're going to have a free and frank discussion that we've talked about. So my thanks to the Print and Media Industry Council, its convener, Greg Edwards, to the two people who have done a lot of the donkey work to bring us together, which is Rob Eden and Neil Jones from the union, and to Paul Tollidge for organising the venue and many of the speakers. So, as I say, I look forward to the debate. I hope you have an enjoyable weekend. Thank you once again, and over to you, Brent.
Thank you. One other thing, sorry, I forgot that to be here you have to be hosted by an MP, and Darren Hughes is the MP who invited us in, so we're able to use these facilities. I'm not going to spend a lot of time introducing our speakers. You've got the notes there, but Dr. Judy McGregor, a former journalist, former newspaper editor, academic, now the Equal Employment Opportunities Commissioner, and we're very pleased to have her to give the keynote address to hopefully start some debate and provoke us into thinking about the role of journalism in New Zealand. So.
Kia ora tātou. Please excuse me, I've got the flu, but I'm here. So I want to congratulate the organisers of this two-day hui because it is one of the very few that I can remember in the past 20 years that has as its established purpose a bid to reclaim journalism. 15 years ago in 1992, Mungo Conwy and I, when we were writing an introduction to a book called Who's News, actually wrote that the news media are dangerously underdebated in New Zealand society. And we went on to say that the silence was aided and abetted by the news rather than the skin news media itself. We had been stoned to death in the week before, writing before, when we had produced a critique of fairness and balance in New Zealand broadcasting news. So it is fitting to, I think, of the union, the Engineering, Printing and Manufacturing Unions behind the summit, because it's organised labour and collective power that has a continuing role in defending freedom of expression and protecting the rights of journalists as workers. Union vigilance has never been more important. If we witness APN's outsourcing of subbing and layout for its daily newspapers, community publications, and magazines. Simon Collins, who is no doubt here and has written, I see a background paper on for this conference, who is the New Zealand Herald's Journalist Collective Delegate, gave voice to this issue with an on-stage protest at the Qantas Awards. He described sub-editors as the second line of defence for the Journalist Code of Ethics, and it is to be hoped that the Code of Ethics gets mentioned this weekend. Amnesty International's slogan recently for Freedom Week was "Make some noise." And it is time that journalists make some noise, not just because they're self-interested parties, but because reporters, sub-editors, photographers, camera operators and presenters must more confidently and consistently defend journalism as the dialogue of democracy. No one else will. I wanted to just address for a minute what is happening, because I think there are shifting tectonic plates under the New Zealand news media at the moment. The seismic activity across the demography, the technology and the economy of the news media, with journalism at its epicentre. Every time there's a tremor within news media ownership or technological development, the aftershocks buffet journalism. Not all of the seismic activity, of course, is causing us to worry about the future of the news. Some of the newer media, whether it be Chinese television channels coming on stream or the newer media, where sources can be publishers and where citizens can be journalists. They're new forms of information distribution which may not necessarily cause fault lines. And I don't want to drudge through a depressing roll call of layoffs such as Television New Zealand's recent cull, or buyouts like private equity investor Ironbridge's purchase of Canwest, or cost cutting through salary outsourcing, because I'm sure that these will come up through the weekend and be debated. And we are all aware too of the slippage in audience ratings and circulations of the old media and the cost cutting pressures that new media have put on the old media because they're faster and they don't have the same cost structures, even if some of them might be profitable or even sensible. And for those of you who have not seen it, Bill Rosenberg's paper on news media ownership in New Zealand provides a really good descriptive and analytical overview that's useful about the change in mediascape. But in my time today, I want to comment on the trifecta of demography, technology and the economy of the news media. I want to talk about whether New Zealand journalism promotes a genuine competition of ideas and opinions. And I want to pose the question, which is, what is it that we want from New Zealand journalism, before suggesting my own very idiosyncratic answers. You'll get your chance later. I've shamelessly pinched some ideas from families and friends, and if you recognise one that's yours, consider this a source acknowledgement. Given the current brouhaha about conflict of interest, I want to disclose before I begin that I'm married to a spin doctor. I want to take technology first. The continuing oscillation of the new media and old media has journalists worried about the unpredictability of new technology, the pace of change and the requirement for dual delivery and hybrid forms. Journalists are anxious about their response plans and the new levels of digital literacy required by some old dogs, whose first loves are those of words, ideas, interviews and civilised conversations, rather than formats, platforms and gadgets. I think a legitimate concern for all journalists is that every woman and her dog can now say whatever they like without fear of repercussion, and often with less fear of adding to meaningful debate in new media formats. Accessibility is the plus, but quality of content is the challenge. Anxiety over the new media also has spawned a ghastly new language, such as remediation, and even worse, disintermediated news. But the less satisfactory aspect of the debate about the new media versus the old media is the certainty of doomsayers that the new will kill off the old. For example, the editor of the Conservative Party website, Tim Montgomery, writing in The Spectator last month, said that the next British election will be won and lost on the internet, and that most newspapers will have closed by 2025. This prognosis not only offends against mainstream journalism as we know it, but also against consumer reality. Because most people use both, if not daily, then regularly, whether they have internet, new services that largely replicate conventional models, or whether they be the new raw models like Scoop Newsroom. And for example, in examining what national leader John Key really did say to the New Zealand Herald about his support for the compromise proposal on Trans-Tasman Therapeutics Agency, I read the New Zealand Herald story in both hard copy and on a website. Then I read with interest the National Party's press statement on the website. Then with heightened anticipation, I read New Zealand political Herald political editor Audrey Young's blog entitled, I'm Bloody Angry with Kiwi, to which the majority of respondent bloggers said they didn't give a toss. Sorry about that, Audrey. Journalism professor Lloyd Lensdale resorted to conjugal metaphors when he was here recently, stating that his enduring relationship with David Broadchutz was a comfortable marriage, while his growing reliance on the web was an extramural affair. The current state of media flux signals the future of multi-platforms for the distribution of news and information requiring digital age skills. It poses new ethical challenges, such as political journalists with their own blogs criticising sources of news, a development that I think needs much more discussion in the New Zealand context. The transition also challenges traditional thinking about who gathers the news and how. Reuters had 2,300 journalists and 100 strings worldwide when the Indian Ocean tsunami hit, but none of them were on the beaches to witness the disaster. Reuters chief executive Tom Gosser told the Online Publishers Association that amateurs filled the void. For the first 24 hours, the best and only photos and video came from tourists armed with 1.3 megapixel portable telephones, digital cameras and camcorders. And if you didn't have those pictures, you weren't on the story, he said. But there is one thing that the new old media confusion doesn't radically change. And that is the central purpose of journalism, cutting to the bone, identifying reliable and informed sources, and producing quality news, information, and commentary. We can't blame amateurs or technology for dull, sloppy, complacent journalism. We can only blame ourselves. I want to move to the second leg of the trifecta, demography. And this is something that this is not an emphasis at this conference, and I think somewhat sadly it needs to be linked in because it's critical. Disinterested youth are one of the usual suspects in the blame game for falling ratings and circulation slides. In my day as an editor, Murdoch's board harped on about including sports results and sports sections. Youth demographic pressures are even stronger now, connected to increasing commercial pressures in advertising. I could never actually believe that young people are uninterested in news, but I do think that they and others are dissatisfied with what is chosen as news, which is quite another matter. An American study by the Northwestern University's Media Management Center said that what people wanted as first and second choices from news was one, stories about ordinary people, and two, stories about how I fit into my community. Crime stories came in at 8th place, and sport at 9th place. Just imagine if we were to ask savvy young people to design a daily newspaper bottom-up. Would they reserve 2 pages every day for yesterday's stock exchange listings, which were available on the web? Would they reserve a further 2 pages for horse racing? There were 13 tabloid pages yesterday on Raceform, the New Zealand Herald Sport Racing Institute. Would these youngsters defy commercial logic and print 10 letters only by telling 50 other subscribers their points have been noted? And I think that youth are only part of the demography problem for the New Zealand mainstream media. In the 2006 census, nearly a third of all New Zealanders identified as being of Maori, Pacific and Asian descent. And whether you use the JTO's 2006 survey or James Holling's interrogation of the 2006 census data, the results are embarrassing. Either 81% or 83% of journalists are European Pakeha, depending on which data is used. The proportion of Maori, Pacific and Asian in newsrooms is pitifully low, and this has been a structural, systemic problem for decades. Fairfax deserves kudos for the composition of its first journalism interns then, with 5 Maori, 1 Chinese and 1 Pacific Islander chosen from 230 applicants in the first 17. and a job for the incoming JTO organisation's executive should be an audit of the 11 journalism schools in New Zealand by diversity of selection. I predict that Wairiki and AUT, Auckland University of Technology, may be the only schools that will pass.
You're wrong. Just done.
Okay, right, I'm sure you'll tell me, Jim. The composition of journalism has resulted in Māori News' bad news syndrome, noted by researchers such as Rangiwi Walker, Derek Fox, the late Michael King, Gary Wilson and others in the past 30 years. And is Asian News now following the same pattern? North and South's magazine cover story, Asian Angst, written by former MP Deborah Coddington, whipped the blankets off the Press Council, who found reportorial failure in relation to accuracy and discrimination. Asian Angst also revealed what I think is quite a repugnant editorial rationale. ACP's group manager said the magazine had always been provocative, and the Press Council decision was, quotes, igniting interest in the title, end of quotes. In a spirited column on media ethics at the Crossroads, press columnist Simon Cundall stated, how revealing, no matter how long, contemptible, or just plain ignorant your article might have been, if it was raising the profile of the magazine, then it was justified. Come again. The representation of ethnicity and diversity in the mainstream media defies business case arguments and represents a fault line in New Zealand journalism, one of its own making. I want quickly to move to the third leg, the economy of the news media. This is probably the most complex and warrants serious debate this weekend. It has been characterised in New Zealand by very few restrictions on cross-media ownership, increasing overseas concentration of ownership, and a fallout, perhaps, you know, lingering fallout of deregulation of state broadcasting. All of these have led to increased homogenisation of content, including shared content, and commodification of news as product. The conglomerate gobble-up has been accompanied in New Zealand by the development of a parallel universe, with new niche market players, some of them state-funded, like Māori Television Service or the 21 EV stations and Pacific Network, and new commercially-based ethnic broadcasters serving Auckland in particular, and community stations elsewhere. We have a uniquely cluttered radio spectrum, and probably there is more media overall for every New Zealander than almost anywhere else in the developed world. And the question that bedevils us, I think, is because there is no easy answer, is really quite simple. Is great journalism compatible with good business in the context of the current media marketplace? It's a question that the United States Media Watch Group, the Aspen Institute, asked and came to the cautious conclusion that substantive reporting and corporate performance can coexist, but only if the news media was prepared to downgrade their greed projections and punch complacency, which I think are the industry's ingrained toxins. That's the serious bit. Now, at random, and because it's completely accessible, I've picked commentary in the New Zealand Press to examine whether commercialism is defeating the competition of ideas and the contest of opinion and character. I've used a completely unscientific methodology, trawling through all sorts of publications for about the last month. If something didn't excite me in the first three cards, I gave up on it. I eliminated business sections from my trawl on the basis that no financial journalist, to my knowledge, warned mum and dad investors about Bridgeport, even though they subsequently smugly tell us they all knew about Rob Petrusevich. I have to acknowledge that Karen Sher did a brilliant job in the Business Herald yesterday, but it is still post facto. So here are my observations on current column activity and commentary in the New Zealand Press. Number one, I wonder just how often Colin James has been right with his political prediction or analysis in the past 20 years. Number two, can we imagine just how badly Auckland might be run without Brian Rudman? Number three, surely there is a C-plus essay for a history student identifying the recurring revisionism of Michael Bassett. How many columns, and I understand it's here today, and I'm sure people take this in an affectionate way, which it's meant, how many columns do grumpy hats like Richard Long and Carl Dufresne have to write to keep them in vintage port? Would life be poorer without the collective irritations of Rosemary McLeod, Martin Van Vanen, and the hyperbolic Michael Wars? Isn't it comforting to be able to kickstart or affirm your own thinking by reading the classic Tapumisa and the elegant Finley McDonald? When I think of holier than thou, why does the name Garth George spring to mind? I did write this before Chris Crocker wrote his column yesterday. Has anyone calculated how many personal pronouns Chris Crocker uses in a year? He used two more in his column yesterday, bagging this conference. My verdict, though, on the current state of commentary is one of cautious optimism. There is a widespread of column opinion to the left and to the right of the political spectrum. Some of it elegantly written, some of it silly, some of it vain, and some of it sensible. And while commentary may not be earth-shattering in consequence, columns reveal what agendas have been set for public debate and challenge and reinforce or ratify how readers should think about these issues. It was Aristotle who told us soft ground shakes more than hard rock in an earthquake. The press commentary is predominantly written by men, and I'm nervous about shared columns in regional media, of course, because that limits the number of new voices that can push in to participate. It also reduces the opportunity for local talent and local subject matter. But on the whole, New Zealand press columnists are neither timid nor tepid, and nor are they anonymous, unlike some editorials. One last word on columns. If I had to read another self-promotion of his bird book by Steve Rawlings, I'm going to take the bell off my cat. So what is it that we want from journalism? When Truth was sold recently, that old master of tabloid journalism, Alan Hitchens, was asked, I think by 2020 or Sunday, to look at the first edition under new ownership. And he was asked if Truth would survive. And he said it would if it was what the punters wanted. And I think we have to ask ourselves, what do we as punters want? And here's my list, and I'm sure you all have your own. I've got 12 points. I want to be proud of journalism because it does the job. More power to the American television newscaster for MSNBC, who repeatedly set alight shredded news stories about Paris Hilton and refused to read them out. Where is she? The Millie Elder, the media's deification of David Bain, and for seven-legged lambs. My second point is that I want journalism that's cheeky, brave, and a surprise. Because we're assaulted by a blizzard of information in every time the exit is done, there's no return on formulaic predictability. I mean, does anyone have time anymore for an hour of television news? A structure dictated by commercialism and dominated by panic. My third point is that I want journalism that occasionally tackles big ideas, even if it means that editors and news managers occasionally come a cropper. In Samuel Beckett's words, ever try, never fail. No matter, try again, fail better. I want journalism that is capable of humour. Is the filming of somnolent politicians to be our only satirical highlight? And are there others who lament the apparent passing of the searingly good New Zealand cartoonist? Malcolm Walker's cartoon of Muldoon blowing his brains out, the roulette cartoon that was published at snap election time. There were 100 calls in the first hour after Sunday news hit the streets. I wouldn't imagine now that it's probably 5 about most modern cartoons. My fifth point, which caused some controversy at home, is that I want political journalism that gets beyond groupthink, the mini-scandal, the cell phone, the politically motivated OIA drop, and Investigate magazine. I want journalism that exposes humbug with ignorant lurks in political and public life and in corporate speech, even down to how many vitamin C enriched blackcurrants really do lurk in a Ribena bottle. Journalism blames the imbalance of resources between the spin industry and the news media for the current state of affairs. But does the media industry adequately invest in senior journalists so they don't have to go over to the dark side to pay the mortgage? And are newsroom cultures such that senior journalists feel valued if they're still in writing or in producing or in production modes? I want journalism to be able to criticise itself. I was once dumped by a listener editor who said no one in New Zealand was interested in media analysis. He lasted only a very little time himself. We can be thankful for Radio New Zealand's commitment to Media Watch, and we can be thankful for Radio Live's newer interest in media analysis, and for those who print regular media analysis well done. We can continue to be disappointed about television's enduring indifference to a dedicated Media Watch programme. I want more debate about journalism ethics, including the invidious creep of self-censorship. I'm hoping that the Press Council's recent review is a sign that the Council wants to become a more credible regulator. Now we have 11 journalism schools. Is there room for an accessible annual state of the media review with public and practitioner appeal as well as academic rigour? I congratulate David Roby on Pacific Journalism Review, but I'd still like something that's out there in the public arena annually. I'd like to see regional news rather than homogenised Don Press product. It was not many years ago that a former editor of the Press, Vinnie Locke, refused to sell his political coverage to stablemates on the basis that it would be like giving up a bit of ourselves. I want local news from community newspapers dedicated to more than DVD reviews. My 10th thing that I want is internet journalism of blogs that are not witless, desk-bound, and full of self-indulgent me, me, me. I want the new media to be able to promote and defend themselves on the basis of utility and relevance, rather than just being the fastest draw in town. Ironically, perhaps the best blogger in New Zealand, Russell Brown of Public Address, uses old-fashioned journalistic techniques such as research to underpin a point of view. I want good news and bad news about Māori and from Māori journalists, and I want good news and bad news about the Pacific too, news that is gathered both here and there, and is more than just coconut cyclones and coups. Television New Zealand's commitment through Barbara Dreamer should be matched by Television 3. Fairfax has its redoubtable veteran, Michael Field, while Radio International is in a league of its own. The Waikato Times this year began a weekly Pacific column, and I know that Gerald uses Sherelle Jackson as a stringer in Samoa and has entered the Red Room. Well done, but there's not enough of it. My 12th point is that I want strong public interest, public service broadcasting. Even if the price of that is waking up each morning to Sean Plunkett berating the world for not answering the question. I'm sure you all have your top 12 too. I want to move in conclusion to what I call an agenda for change. I very much hope that the next 2 days involve everyone asking hard questions. But personally, I would like this summer to have an outcome. I'd like to see, I don't know, a concluding statement or a communique with new ideas, shared conclusions, and perhaps strategies for action that will create public interest in helping journalism matter. Various sectors of the journalism community this week committed to an annual political scholarship for an emerging journalist in tribute to veteran wordsmiths Ian Templeton's 50 astonishing years in the Parliamentary Press Gallery. It has been a very good week for reclaiming journalism. I think it would be a lost opportunity if this weekend's spirited and robust debate was a private conversation and a talk fest, however stimulating, without traction. Journalism will only matter if those that do it and love it protect its integrity. With apologies for Amnesty, I do urge you to make some noise. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for that, Judy.
stimulating debate and address, and hopefully will provoke some reaction. So for the rest of the time, it's now your opportunity to ask questions or make a comment on something. For me, I'd be keen to hear Carl's answer about how it takes the bottle for. But please, any comments or questions? I think we made a point, the success of the weekend depends on your involvement. We've arranged it where we're not just going to have people speak to you, but where hopefully you'll contribute as much. Yeah, sorry, down, Jim, down the back. Okay, sorry, can you just wait for a light?
Sorry, Judy, that I butted into really, but we have just done a survey on the diversity of journalism students, and the results are, as you can say, I know, I haven't got the figures with me, but from memory, that's published. 14% of journalism students this year out of 250 are Māori. If you take the wire reading, 16 out of that, then the figure looks good, about 4%. We have 10 Pacific Island students. In the extended journalism schools, by the way, that's about 4%. We have one Asian student in New Zealand each year. So those figures don't match the recent census figures, of course. 9% of our population now trace the Pacific Islands, so they're identified as Pacific Islands, and we have 4% of them. In terms of students. AUT is not doing as well as you say. Only 3 of their students are Māori, and only 3 are Pacific Island this year. Fitzgerald has half the students from those cohorts, but it only has 8 this year, so those figures are probably misleading as well. So the figures are, in my opinion, not good.
Thanks, Brody from AUT. I'd just like to add something to what Jim had to say. Because in the School of Communication Studies, something over 800 students, and overall for the school, in fact, we do match the census figures. Where the problem is in journalism. We match the figures of radio and television, public relations, across the school overall. And it's something that the school is actually, I think, approaching in a very positive way. For example, we started just this week, on Tuesday, we had a day-long workshop for Māori and Pacifica students. We had 35 of them from the schools, South Auckland, West Auckland, and so on, where they're basically exposed to the school's activities overall, with the newspapers, the library, the television studios, and also radio strategies. Radio station produced out of the school, and mini lectures and so on. Basically, this is going to be a regular thing if we do it. So all I want to say is that yes, it's a grim picture overall, but there are some quite positive things happening to our nation. Thanks.
Yeah. Gavin Ellis, I'm a Hanau student. Judy, I was interested in the comment that you made about the blog that Audrey ran. I'd be interested in your comments on what are the ethical issues that you see involved in journalists using blogs to perhaps go beyond the story itself.
First of all, Audrey, I absolutely and thoroughly respect your right to say how grumpy you were, because I do think there are times when politicians just simply claim that journalists have lied and that journalists have no way of protecting themselves unless their editors take some sort of strong stand. So I absolutely respect that. My concern, though, is journalists, particularly writing in mainstream media where they have to have continuing relationships with politicians as sources, I think it's the notion of attacking sources that worries me. So self-defence is fine, although it was interesting. I read very carefully, and Audrey, I must admit I only read the first day, I read the first run on the blog. Now, apart from those who were taking a political stand, overtly political stand, either for John Key or against him, and there was some very interesting, that was some very interesting stuff. I particularly like the gentleman that described John Key as a second-hand car salesman, who's a well-known cartoonist around, who was on the blog. But for me, I think there is an issue, an ethical issue, about journalists attacking a source. What does that do for an enduring relationship with that source? Do journalists actually have the right to insert themselves into that source reporting relationship in that way? I mean, sure, we're human, and someone actually said on the blog, it's good to see that Audrey was human, because she was, you know, pissed off about it, and I would have been pissed off about it too. But don't we have to be bigger than that to maintain that relationship with the source? And there's nothing that I've heard, I mean, I did hear Colin Espiner on Media Watch defending his blog. There was nothing I heard that was a powerful rationale for having one, frankly. And it's probably just me being an old-fashioned, you know, purist about it, but there were many times, and I do remember once, Muldoon saying that that girl McGregor in Auckland got it wrong, and that was all through the media, and how pissed off I was about that. And I think had I had a blog, I would have gone to town. But at the end of the day, I think there are some serious issues when you attack sources. You've got to think about that. Not just for self-protection and whether they're going to talk to you again, but what does that do to the journalistic relationship in relation to sources? And I mean, I'd like to hear Audrey's defence of that, because I'm not being critical, I just used it as an interesting, you know, episode when I was writing my speech, looking at blog material from journalists.
Audrey, would you like to have a response?
I don't think I'm really quiet.
All right, that's fine. Come. You'll blog about it, though, right?
Carl McCrane, Judy, what you've just been talking about raises a related issue, and that is the increasing tendency for political journalists in particular to actually take the role of players in the political process, yep, rather than simply observers, which is the kind of classical role. Yep. And we see this in the blogs of political writers. We also see it increasingly in television, where journalists such as Duncan Garner mix up comment with reportage to the extent that it becomes almost impossible to tell which is which. Do you have any particular views on that?
I do, but I almost think that celebrification of the journalist has gone now to such an extent that we need to get over it, almost. I think it's irreversible. You know, I remember when we used to rail against questions like, how do you feel? But now, in fact, journalists are not only posing how do you feel to sources of news, they're actually asking, how do I feel, and making that news. And I almost think we just have to accept, Carl, that the piece to camera has so ruined source-journalist relationships that we're not going to be able to turn the clock back on it. We're just going to be able to have to say, how do we determine whether Duncan Garner, you know, has inserted himself to such an extent that the newspaper is no longer legitimate. I mean, for 10 years, I think Margie and I probably, in all our textbooks, railed against celebrification of the journalist. And that's when they were asking, how do you feel? But now they're asking how I feel. You know, how do I, as Duncan Garner, feel about that? I feel it's crap. And that becomes the news. Well, we have to get over it, I think, and decide, is there a way in which we could better equip, in terms of media literacy, people's ability to be able to determine whether that's good journalism or bad journalism? Because we're not going to be able to turn it back, I don't think.
Yeah, no, Martin's from AMC. I haven't actually read Audrey's blog, but I'd just like to speak up for a little bit, because I think for me, what we see here is actually probably a redressing of the imbalance of power between the journalist and the source. If you have a journalist who goes on the record a report, sorry, a source who goes on the record to you, and you publish that, and then they turn and say, oh, I didn't say that. The journalist got it wrong. Traditionally, journalists haven't had a chance to defend themselves, but I think now the interactivity of blogging is changing the way that journalism is done, and I think we have to recognise that, we all do, obviously. And this is perhaps one positive change, but if a journalist feels that that the source is attacking them, well, you know, have done that. And maybe that then will put a bit more pressure back on sources to be more honest with journalists as well. So if we don't get into that situation, you know, if a source goes on the record and then denies that they said that, and it looks like the journalist is making stuff up or misrepresenting somebody, then you can go on, you know, control, turn it around quickly, and not fill up space in the next day's paper. Why not? I think it's a great idea.
Julie, I'd like to ask you, I mean, you talked about the commercial pressures on the media and whether you can balance up good journalism against the commercial needs. Do you think the issue of the concentration of media, what role is that playing in increasing that pressure?
It was interesting to read, I think yesterday, Murdoch's international financial results. And conglomerate ownership is still getting about 13% return out of, you know, newspaper interests. And probably when I was around and many people in the audience were around, newspaper owners were screwing about 25% return out of their newspaper assets. And that's a hell of a lot. And even at 13%, that's a hell of a lot. And I suppose the issue for me is what of that conglomerate profit, what is invested back into the creativity of journalism? I mean, I think over my time, last 20 years, you could see a huge investment in technology, a huge investment in all sorts of things, but what investment has there actually been in the creativity of journalism? What investment is there in newsrooms? You know, journalists are still very, very poorly paid for the work that they do, the hours they work, and the strain and pressures of the job. We may never be able to change ownership structures in New Zealand. We've never had decent cross-media ownership laws. The Commerce Commission has never held the line on a single thing that I can ever think of, apart from red sheds, which are not, you know, about journalism. They've never held the line. So there's no. I don't think there's any point in beating our breast about conglomerate ownership, but the issue for me is what investment is made from profits into journalism. And that's what we should all be asking. And we should be asking people to make it transparent, too, I think, in different sorts of ways. That's a sort of slippery, slidey way around answering that question, Brett.
You're in the right place for those sorts of answers.
You mentioned this briefly, and I'd like to maybe hear a little more depth on the issue. What do you think about the way the media treatment of David Bain has, and what the implications are for sort of reporting of crime and justice system in the
field? Okay, I have to acknowledge that I unashamedly pinched this idea from Clive Lind, who's going to elaborate on it, actually, I understand, further on the weekend. But I am a student of crime coverage in the New Zealand media, having written boringly about it in the past. I feel very strongly that at the end of the day, in the Bain case, regardless of the rights and wrongs of evidence, whether or not Bain is innocent or guilty, etc., there are, in fact, five people that are dead, and I think the media's circus outside the courtroom and their deification of Bain and Karam and etc., was simply unworthy of us. And there have been other recent criminal trials. I believe that the Scott Watson case was in which relatives were hounded, from court, was simply unworthy of us. Particularly now, we've got the added advantage as journalists of coverage in court. And some of the better coverage, I think, that's happening in relation to crime is, in fact, inside the courtroom. I think that the media have sort of deified David Bain in a way that I think is unworthy.
Down back first, Alison.
I'm Alison Martin from the School of Planning. I'm interested in your amount of that since mediation, which is the term which I think we started using about 1999. And in the context of the discussion about Audrey's law, that disintermediation not only means publication of stuff which is not used, which is professional research, but it also means that the relationship between the journalist and the public is not intermediated by the editor or by the publisher, which is probably the positive side of internet journalism. I wondered if you could comment a little bit about what you meant about disintermediation and whether you see benefits coming from new journalism as well as the editors.
In relation to disintermediation, I just think the language is really unfortunate. That was really what I was saying. It's a terrible new vocabulary. I mean, how the hell is anyone meant to understand that without three pages of definition?
That
term
you blamed on Brian
Sweeney, who's a stand-up. I don't care who we blame it on, as long as we blame it on someone. But just, Alistair, I do think that, of course, the internet provides huge access, and there are major democratic advantages in that access. But the thing for me is, you know, much of current blogging isn't terribly thoughtful. And in relation to journalism, you know, you speak about the benefits of there being no filters, but is there anyone in the room that hasn't had copy improved by some sort of checks and balances? You know, let's face it, we probably all live in an age where a sub-editor has actually improved something, or an editor has actually pointed out that there might be another side, or, you know. So the notion that somehow unfiltered news is better than filtered news, I think we need to question, despite the fact that I think there are enormous advantages of access and pace and the fact that, you know, anywhere, everywhere can do it. I think there is need for a huge debate in New Zealand about citizens as journalists, because I think we need to have that debate before the next election, because I think that will hit us as a powerful new force in how politics is reported or how politics is known about. So I don't think that necessarily, just because something doesn't have checks and balances and other sets of eyes going on, it means it's better. I don't want to stand here as a Luddite either. Or sit here as a Luddite, sorry. Sit here as a Luddite.
My name's Josiah, I'm from 95BFM in Auckland. Just going back to the David Bain notification and media scrum, do you think that was a direct result or an illustration of increased commercialisation on media, or that pressure of technology to get to the story immediately, perhaps too quick to actually think about it and present great coverage, or just an example of journalists getting really, really excited about some stuff?
Probably all of the above, but I think there was another factor too, and then I think, you know, Joe Karam is probably a master at what I would call crime spin. And his influence on the whole David Bain deification shouldn't be underestimated. I mean, he's been accessible for the last, you know, 10 years as an instant comment anywhere to the media. I mean, he's probably, if we looked at the column inches and the broadcast tape, you'd find him enormously influential. So all of the things you suggest, plus I put the Joe Karam spin machine in there as well.
But wasn't there a pressure there to get pictures outside?
Yeah, of course there is. But there is some film that I watched that is quite interesting because it had such a look of glee. The media that were involved in that scrum, there's a particular piece of film of Mark Sainsbury looking so excited, looked as though he'd wet his pants. He was so excited that he was so close as he was shepherding Karam out. I mean, and that's what the media was seeing. They were seeing this guy in a white shirt, you know, gawky guy in a white shirt. Thank God for the feral jerseys. Gone. White shirt, then it would probably be part of Joe's spin machine. You know, all of that. But I think many of the public that watched that material would have been, the overwhelming image would have been the sheer excitement of the news media that they were flopping around David Bain.
Isn't it part of also just that the push for personality driven news? So rather than looking at the issue around that particular crime, the personality is not. One thing, for instance, I know the legitimate issue that it is, but whether you're seeing the same thing, for instance, with the Louise Nichols case too.
It just flopped into my mind that having been so negative about some aspects of crime reporting, I do think that Philip Kitchen does need special mention for the incredible job he's done investigating and hanging on to that story. I also think that Louise Nicholas has handled, herself in a much different manner. She hasn't had a joke career. And she takes advice from a group of people about how she needs to present, etc. So, that's the very best of crime reporting, when considered investigation sticks at it, and publications, the Dominion and Television New Zealand stuck with it. And clearly there's more to come, as we see by the Saturday's paper. So there is good crime coverage and bad crime coverage, I think.
Hi, I'm Samantha Hayes from TV3. Just going back to the comments about the Rihanna and the pest of cameras, I wonder, in an age where, as you say, the woman and her dog can say something through something like new media, with mobile phones and all sorts of technology, what the place of the journalist is to provide perhaps more than a depth analysis of an issue, and they are putting their own opinion in it, what is their role, what is the journalist's role?
It's a big question, because one of the things about piece to camera is how damn short they are. I mean, what intelligent person can, sum up, filter, give us the news if it's, going to be less than 60 seconds or whatever. So I think there is need for discussion about not only about the journalist's personality and how much that makes the news. Does the story make the news? Does journalist's personality make the news? I think, for me, one of the issues is how we actually teach people watching the news to distinguish between Duncan Garner's piece to camera and his own opinion and what is the news. Because I think the horse is bolted in relation to personification and personalisation. And I'd have to say that just being with an audience of young people recently, I found them incredibly canny, about, they can tell. They're pretty good at telling. So we should never underestimate the ability of the audience to do that instinctively, although I'd like to see slightly more curriculum training about how to do it properly. I've wriggled around that one too. But it's a very big question, and I'm not sure I've got the answer.
Judy, I wonder how loud I can think about that. I noticed that Ian Templeton's do the other night was a reproduction of the first lead job in the Motor Hills. Further down was a column by Noel Holmes, it has his name on it, and it was Noel Holmes' opinion on a piece, Noel writing that column. Noel telling us about how he felt. So I'm not sure it's that new. It's just that it's become more powerful to television. And I think Mr. Cameron done well is a fine piece of journalism. I agree with you that it needs to be taught. It isn't taught that I'm aware of in most journalism schools. It might well be in the Christchurch Broadcasting School. What I see with Mr. Cameron are people who are so frightened by the prospect of slipping up in the light of Mr. Cameron that are quite positive. In the start of the headlines. I don't really, I guess the ones we see out of America where they're much more accomplished, also possibly a bit more mature, older hip dogs, and they there is a place for that. So I agree with you, we're not going to stand out, but I'm not sure if that new either. Print's done for a long time. We've had the gradual growth of bylines from the days when you and I began, you didn't get a byline for anything, to a point now where you but I read Kerry Wellman's piece this morning about Victoria Crossman going back to his Marae in
interested in what you covered very briefly, is the fact that editors don't no longer live in the community that they're publishing. And the big concern for me is the not only the replacement of New Zealand journalists, but I see journalists, but overseas news all the time. I mean, the small field that I work in, science journalism, it's almost exclusively reported from overseas instead of the very good stuff that happens here. And it's even more galling when you're reporting on the work of a New Zealand scientist, for instance, but the overseas reporter doesn't know that it's a New Zealand scientist.
Yeah.
And I just, there are big major conferences. I think one in Christchurch recently, and Evolution, the first time it's ever been held outside North America, 900 evolutionary biologists, etc. Couldn't get that story anymore. You know, it was not published anywhere, there was not very much written about it. There were top scientists coming out here, and I find that incredibly frustrating. And so I'm much more worried about not what the quality of the columnists, it's just that there's so many of those columnists and not enough just simple reporting of actually what's happening in the community.
Yep. Well, I can continue my campaign to get rid of racing. Racing, there are 13 tabloid pages devoted to racing form. Because if at the end of the day it's about pressure of space and pressure of content, you know, one of the things I am interested in about science, having come from an academic institution, is the marked reluctance of many scientists to make themselves newsworthy. I mean, we do have an exception in New Zealand of Paul Callaghan, but I almost think he's got overexposed because he's the only scientist that sort of seems to front everything from whatever. But I do think there is an issue for scientists in particular to make sure that they are actually able to translate their technical expertise.
I'm sorry, I really disagree with that.
I have to disagree with that. I don't think Callaghan is the one everyone goes to, but there are a zillion of them out there. So,
do we hear a zillion of them?
No one takes the stuff. I presume it's, perhaps our next panel can answer it, commercial pressure again, that there's no money in science apart from doing science research.
Just on those 13 racing pages.
Yeah. I knew that had to be.
I should point out that the racing industry pays the Herald for the space. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a very good commercial deal, and it was negotiated by a number of the men, I think.
I'm not sure that makes it any better for me.
40% of the audience.
Well,
Sorry, I just want to back up now on the Academy of Science Stories, because my name is Kara, I'm very much in college, and I'm a director of documentary, and I talked about it in the last time. But I was involved in making a kids' series about New Zealand scientists. There are hundreds of really great talented scientists out there doing really amazing stuff. When we had the program, particularly New Zealand, yes, put money into it, we got money from all sorts of private and research institutes. But we went here to New Zealand and checked it properly, they didn't mark it, not one other print journalist picked up any story. And it was devastating, really, because it's a fantastic program.
Can I just say that it's a big answer to the message. It's very easy to blame on scientists not having their reports easy enough or strong enough. I think it's one of the great misunderstandings that most scientists are aware of the space of public funding. They need to get their information out to the public. Most journalists just don't defend it. I believe science is a problem to people. It's just a great misunderstanding. I mean, it's just...
I just want to come back and respond very briefly to something that Jim said. You mentioned there have been columns for a very, very long time. Of course, he's perfectly right. He referred to an old Owens column. We had opinion columns for as long as anybody can remember. My concern was really more specific. Those were opinion columns that were quite clearly identifiable as opinion columns and as the opinion of the writer. My concern is much more specific. It's about instances of news reportage and comment and opinion being interspersed in one in the one segment, in the one item, so that they're no longer clearly distinguishable. And the viewer or the reader, because this goes on in newspapers too, loses track of what is actually news and what is the opinion of the journalists. That's my concern.
Look, I'm looking at time, and I think we've got plenty of time for further discussion. So I'd like to close the session now to thank Judy for her address, which clearly has prompted a lot of thought and debate, which will carry on through the rest of the day and tomorrow. So thank you very much.
Thank you.